This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
This podcast brought to you by My Patriot Supply. Did you miss the chance to get a 72-hour emergency food supply with free shipping for just $10? What's wrong with you? Don't worry. Call 888-411-7440 right now. They have a few left, and they're selling out fast. 888-411-7440. What are you waiting for? A disaster? Do it right now. 888-411-7440.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. It is Wednesday before Thanksgiving, day before Thanksgiving. I know a lot of you are probably either finishing up your last day in the office. Some of you might be working tomorrow, and I know I've worked many a holiday in my day. But I feel like most of you are going to be off, or many of you will be off, I would hope, tomorrow to be with your families and friends and to share a holiday that allows us all to take a little bit of a deep breath. So I will do news with you today, and we'll get into some of our usual important matters and issues and all the rest of it. But I thought I would sort of switch the script a little bit and first just start off by saying that the thing that I am thankful for this year, other than, of course, my family and my friends, is all of you, is those of you who listen to the show every day, those of you who download my podcast, who send me words of encouragement and friendship when I leave the friendly territory that is the Blaze to go elsewhere sometimes to do the occasional debate segment or to go face down liberal myths and half-truths and such in debates. So I thank you all very much for that. And I'm thankful for Team Buck, quite honestly. That's what it really comes down to. I have recently had the experience a few times of trying to explain to somebody how it is that a guy who was a CIA analyst by trade ended up in a relatively short period of time. Some people tell me it's crazy short. I don't know. I'm kind of new to this business. I don't know how long these things take. But in a relatively short period of time, I would have gone from doing that to hosting a radio show and a TV show here at The Blaze. So I'm thankful for that, and obviously for those at The Blaze that have made all this possible, those who took risks on me early on, gave me opportunities, and put me in a position where I could have this time with all of you. So instead of, this is the sort of thing that usually I think I would wait until the end of the show to say. Instead, today, I'm sure by the end of the show, we'll be talking about, you know, some of latest counterterrorism effort or something. I figured we would talk about this now while I have many of you joining in early on the show. I feel like some of you I might, by the third hour, because of traffic or, you know, because of your Wi-Fi signal wherever you are, it's possible that now is the best opportunity to get on the air and say that to all of you. So really, I am thankful for all of you. I'm deeply appreciative every single day. I wake up every day and really like what I do. I get excited to do this, and so I'm thankful for that. It's not always been the case. I've had jobs before that I really, it was a job. You know, and I know many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. You show up and you do your gig and you get a paycheck, and that there's honor in that, and that's what you're doing. But it's a special thing when you get to spend your days and your hours. I mean, I go home and I get excited. I mean, I nerd out about this. I get excited prepping for the show because I'm like, oh, this is going to be so cool to get to talk to the team about this tomorrow. And I stay up all late at night, and I keep sometimes pretty crazy hours because of it. And so I'm just deeply thankful for all of that. I'm thankful to be here to have the Freedom Hut, which I really do feel like we've all created together. This is something that came together because many of you joined me on Saturdays when it was like, yeah, we'll just do a radio show, guys. Let's go for it. And some of you have been with me from the very earliest days. So I hope you don't mind that I took a moment to just say that that's, other than my family, and I have a wonderful family, and I have some very wonderful friends as well. But right now, what's different? I mean, I've fortunate that I've had a wonderful family my whole life. What I'm thankful for now that's different is is this, is all of you, is the Freedom Hut, the Blaze, and Team Buck. So you guys are all very special. I feel like I know all of you, even those who don't necessarily interact with me by calling into the show or tweeting at me or writing on Facebook. I do feel like I know all of you. And I also feel like you're with me even when I'm out representing our ideas and beliefs elsewhere and having having the opportunity to mix it up occasionally. I know the team is with me, and that's also why I don't mind the boos from the other side and the mean emails and the you just think you're Michael J. Fox from Family Ties, don't you? And somebody once told me that I look like Mrs. Doubtfire. I mean, these are the things that you get when you come off of TV. You're like, wow, that's pretty intense. So anyway, I appreciate very much that not only do you join me here, but you're all with me. And so that is the one opening I will do for the foreseeable future. We're not talking about hard news. We're not talking about what's going on in the world. I just want to say I'm thankful for all of you. I really am, honestly and truly. And with that in mind, I thought we could go into a story that's a little heartwarming. We're going to get into Putin and Syria and politics and all that in just a minute, I promise. This is not, we're not totally throwing out the script of the usual Freedom Hut fare. But I thought we would switch into a story that's catching a fair amount of attention right now. It's from the New York Daily News that a newborn baby boy was found in a Queens church. He was placed in the nativity scene. As you know, the nativity scenes are starting to get placed out in front of churches or in churches. And he was found in the cradle. He was in the nativity scene. I mean, usually you wait until, of course, Christmas, and that's when the baby Jesus is put in the creche or in the nativity scene. And in this case, a baby that still had the umbilical cord attached. So when we're talking about a newborn baby, we mean a newborn baby. And he was swaddled in purple towels in the creche. So instead of the usual, what you would expect, of course, in this kind of a circumstance, is that there would be a little plastic or porcelain baby Jesus on December 25th. And here we are on November 25th, a month in advance, and the custodian at this church in Queens found a little tiny baby in the scene. Now, the baby's fine. Of course, somebody left this baby and assumed that it would be found, I guess, relatively quickly. This is not the best way to get an adoption started, obviously, not the most effective or safest way, but the baby's fine. The baby was found by the custodian, and it was an interesting story. He said he was in the church sweeping, which, by the way, as some of you may be noting as I'm talking about this, the guy who sweeps out and takes care of the church, a little trivia question for you, he's called a sexton, hence my last name. A sexton is a guy who takes care of a church, not to be confused with sextant, which I've been at many a cocktail party, and somebody's like, oh, it's a device that uses astronomy and when you're in the, uses the position of the stars when you're out on the sea to tell you where you're going. And that's a sextant. A sexton is the guy who takes care of a church, sweeps out the church, collects donations, occasionally will be the one who tends to graves. And in this case, the sexton found the baby. Sexton is the one who found the baby. So Sexton finds baby could in fact be the headline of this daily news story. So he said he looked around and heard the cries, and he obviously was not expecting there to be a baby in the nativity scene. And so he then went over and saw, and he says at least whoever abandoned him brought him to a safe place and didn't leave him to die, which is true. The baby's fine. The baby just got a clean bill of health at Jamaica Hospital and was in the care of the Administration of Children's Services. Cops are trying to track down the mom. Yeah, this is not the way to do it. But baby will be okay, and that's the most important thing. And there are already parishioners who have offered to adopt the baby. There are already willing adoptive parents who live in this parish in Queens who've said they would. There's at least one parishioner has already offered to adopt baby Jesus. They're calling the baby, of course, baby Jesus.
and others are calling him John the Baptist. So this was a nice little quote. This child was a gift to the church in a poetic way, so we'd love to see him stay in the community. The baby's going to be fine. He's going to be adopted, and there are already offers, as I said. And, yeah, Sexton finds baby in nativity scene. Headline in the Daily News. Well, that would be the headline I would write for the Daily News. I just thought that was a nice story. By the way, I want to hear your stories, Thanksgiving stories or otherwise, whatever you want to talk about. We're very, very loose and open here. I mean, I'm just sort of imagining myself hanging out with all of you wherever you are. If you're already starting some of the prep for tomorrow's marathon cooking, or if you're somebody who orders in Chinese and just watches football, you know, we're hanging out. 888-900-3393. Team Buck, I am thankful for you, and I'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Dispensing the truth. This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
Consider this, Team Buck, a early Freestyle Friday, because, of course, I'll be off from the Freedom Hut Thursday and Friday. So consider this what I think I called it Buck Wild Wednesday, which I don't know. That sounds like that's a little too crazy. But, yes, you can call in 888-900-3393. Leave the phone lines open for the whole show. We've got a couple of guests joining us throughout the 3 hours here. So we got a lot to go through. We got a lot to talk about. What was I going to say? Oh, yes, of course. Sorry. I was getting a little misty eyed here thinking about Team Buck, and I'm thankful for all of you, but now I've got to get down to business. And what were we going to start with? Oh, yes. So counterterrorism in New York City. This is from the Wall Street Journal. New York ramps up counterterrorism effort as holidays approach, and the Paris attacks have prompted extra security in New York for the Macy's parade and also for the New Year's Eve ball drop. Now, look, I am absolutely a realist when it comes to all of this stuff, and I would never pretend that these are or you know, put on an air that I have no concerns at all about this. Right? There's anyone who is, I think, well informed on these issues right now. Anybody who's well informed about the intentions of not just the Islamic State, but also Al-Qaeda. And don't forget, there are lone wolf jihadists as well. There are people who, for whatever reason, and there are many reasons, the precondition, of course, is a belief in jihad, but how they get there, that can vary, that might decide to take it upon themselves to try to just ruin what should be a joyous time of year by even just harming one person, even if it'll manage to kill them, even if it's just one person who's stabbed or attacked or hit with a hatchet. Or so there's a huge span of the sort of attack that may occur over the next couple of weeks, and everyone feels like there is a heightened threat. And of course, you know, there's a part of us that would say, well, if something does happen, heaven forbid, at least we would hope that our security forces here would be able to prevent it from becoming anything catastrophic as what we saw in Paris. I mean, it's very, I can imagine right now, and I haven't had the chance to get over there, but I'm sure it's a very eerie feeling right now in Paris, even in the aftermath of something like that. That takes a while. You know, as a New Yorker, I wasn't in New York on 9/11. I was actually up at college. I remember the day very, very well, and I remember thinking to myself that the world had changed. I also remember in the weeks before that thinking that it sort of felt like, and this was a young and naive thing to think, but it sort of felt like America was just, we had won in a sense. It was all the big battles, all the dragons that had to be slayed had been slayed, right? That we had defeated the Soviet Union, and there were these little things here and there. I remember thinking about that maybe in the months before 9/11, but it had crossed my mind before. I was like, what is the next big fight? And I thought, oh, well, like a lot of other people, maybe I'll just go and try to make a living and just do my thing and not have to worry about this. And then 9/11 happened. It changed, obviously, many lives. It changed the trajectories of many lives. People like me decided that they wanted to get involved in the fight in some way. I joined the CIA because of 9/11. That was what spurred me to do it. It was the first job, the first full-time position I ever applied for was the CIA. I remember actually I was with a group of friends and sitting around, and I told them that I'd sent in an application to the CIA, and they all thought that was hilarious because, you know, they thought James Bond, and I had this grandiose notion of what this was really going to be. I didn't really know much about it, to be honest with you. I just knew that I thought I would be good at it for some reason, which I don't know. Sometimes you just get that feeling. Like, I had never done radio, and I told our radio program director, Dom Theodore, I said, Dom, I love radio. I listen all the time. I think I'll be good at this. And, you know, whatever. You can judge whether that's a true statement or not, but at least I thought it at the time. And I thought I would be good at the CIA. And I think I was, actually. I was a good analyst. I was well-regarded, I'll say that. So, but lives change and trajectories change as a result of 9/11. And I think in a similar way, a lesser way, but there are some similarities to it. What happened in Paris will also change perspectives, and it will take some time for that to really filter out. But this is all my way of saying that going into this holiday season, it's really essential that you don't allow. And I know that there are these cliched phrases you'll hear people say, you know, we can't, if you're afraid, the terrorists have already won. Right. Well, I mean, that's not really true in the sense that, yeah, you can be a little nervous, but we're still living a free society for now. And we still are America, and you know, we're going to be okay. And it's not, the terrorists have not won yet, just because we're nervous about security over a holiday period here. But I do think it's essential that you try to the greatest degree possible. And I know it depends on where you are in the country too. People who are in large urban centers do feel like they're more likely to be the scene of a jihadist terror attack than, say, in more rural areas, just because of population concentration, right? That's a very straightforward proposition. Where there are more people, there are more targets, and that's where the terrorists are going to focus. And there's also the symbolism, right? The symbolism of attacking New York or Washington, D.C. And I've already been getting people, I've had people texting me, and I mean, there's a part of me that just has to say, you know, it's come on, guys, I've been out for a while. People text me, say, you know, can you ask some of your former associates if anything bad's going to happen in New York? And I always want to tell them, you know, first of all, unfortunately, I'm not really in the game in that sense anymore. I'm not getting the day-to-day threat reporting, which I'm thankful for, because that stuff can wear on you after a while. It keeps you up thinking at night. But depending on how high the threat level is at any given time. But also, let me just say that if the FBI, if the federal intelligence agencies, if the federal law enforcement agencies really believed that there was an imminent threat against a specific thing, this is not the kind of information that would be suppressed and they would just tell everybody to go about. You know, if there was an imminent threat against, say, the subway in New York City, which there have been in the past, there was an imminent threat with Najib El-Azazi, who I think got, I don't know if it was 30 or 40 years in prison as a result of that plot. But they take action right away. And if they didn't think that they had been able to stop the plot in progress, they would tell people to stay. They would tell people to stay away as well. So there's not this super secret trove of threat reporting that's imminent and well-sourced that, you know, you would know, is kind of what I'm trying to tell you, that the public would generally know if there was something that was so hard and fast that someone, even on the inside, like I used to be, would see it and say, oh, well, I'm not letting my... And this was always a discussion that happened a few times, by the way. You were told when you held a clearance, you know, if you find something out, if you find out that there's an imminent threat or something, just so you know, it is your obligation, you know, not to tell your relatives or something to stay out of a certain airport or whatever. And we all kind of sat there and shook our heads and were like, yeah, buddy, I don't think so. You know, I'm not sitting around with that on my conscience. I'm taking care of my family. You can prosecute me later. It's not what we told them, but that's what everybody thought. We talked about it afterwards. We're like, yeah, I don't think that's, sorry. Don't think we're going to let that one go. You know, that's one thing I think the federal government sometimes forgets. It's like, yes, you be a patriot. Be responsible and respectful and love your country, but family first, family before federal government. Sorry. But anyway, so this is my way of trying to tell you that as I'm getting the emails from people I know and they're saying, oh, are you worried? I can't tell you that nothing will happen, but I can tell you that there's nothing you can do about it. And that the best thing you can do is to enjoy the holiday season with your family as much as you or friends, or even if this is time for you. Some of you maybe are spending it solo. Some of you might be deployed somewhere. Some of you might be on your own. But take some time to just reflect and enjoy yourself as much as you can. Don't let them take that away from you. Doesn't mean that the terrorists have won if they do, but it would just be unfortunate and it's unnecessary. We've got a lot of good people who are working 24/7 to stop the bad guys. Trust in them just a little bit this time.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
This podcast brought to you by My Patriot Supply. Did you miss the chance to get a 72-hour emergency food supply with free shipping for just $10? What's wrong with you? Don't worry. Call 888-411-7440 right now. They have a few left, and they're selling out fast. 888-411-7440. What are you waiting for? A disaster? Do it right now. 888-411-7440.
Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, the phone lines here are open, 888-900-3393. We are doing sort of loose format show, so we can take calls throughout unless we have a guest on, and we do right now. We have Tom Nichols. He is a senior contributor at The Federalist. You all know TheFederalist.com. We have a lot of them here on the show. Tom, thank you very much for calling in.
Thanks for having me, Buck.
So we know that in the aftermath of the shoot down of a Russian plane and then a Russian helicopter yesterday, there's been a heavy bombardment against some areas in Syria's Latakia province, and that Russian warplanes are flying even more sorties now than they had in the past. What does this shoot down mean? I mean, yesterday there were a lot of blaring headlines, a lot of talk about World War III. So we got a Russian plane shot down by Turkish fighter jets. What now?
Well, it means a lot of things. There was a lot of talk about World War III because, let's face it, a NATO country, a member of the NATO alliance, shot down a Russian jet. This is the kind of thing that would have had everybody's hair standing on end 30 years ago, and it's still worth having at least a certain amount of concern about. But it means a couple of things. First of all, it Putin increasing his bombardments. You could have set your watch by that. This is a guy whose reaction to everything is to double down. And I think Americans these days particularly are not used to that kind of a world leader who just doesn't budge. And Putin is a thug, and Putin does not back down in the face of a challenge, which is what makes him so dangerous. He's like a bad gambler. When he gets beat at a hand, his next hand is to push more chips onto the table. The other thing that I think is getting missed in all the immediate kind of concern about this particular incident is the much larger problem that this is the kind of stuff that happens, that's going to happen when the Americans pull out and leave a power vacuum behind them. That when the United States doesn't lead, when the United States is not involved and it turns its back on world affairs, other powers will move into the vacuum and some of those powers will collide. And that was my concern that's been my concern for years about Syria, on top of the obvious concern that hundreds of thousands of people are dying. I think I and a lot of other people, especially those of us who are Russia watchers, have always had a concern that anywhere the United States just pulls away and leaves nothing in its wake, that other powers, including Russia, especially in the Middle East, that Russia will move in to fill the void. And when Russia moves in to fill the void, people start running into each other in bad ways like this.
I think, Tom, as a former intel officer, whenever I look at this problem or I see this playing out, I'm reminded that there is this reactionary and almost knee-jerk anti-interventionism that people will tie into. Well, if we weren't there, then it would just be, if we weren't involved in the Middle East, it would be the people of the various countries of the Middle East left to their own affairs. They would be figuring it out themselves. There would be. And then you think to yourself, well, wait a second. Not only is that not true, but actually it opens the door for even greater meddling by other powers, other intel services, other groups. You can think about this in the context of Iran and what it does outside of its borders, Russia, what it does, China, what it does. All of these countries have stakes in what's playing out. You know, they're all moving pieces on the chessboard, and I just think it's a very easy. It's far too neat and clean in many people's minds that, well, if only America wasn't there, that would solve all the problems. No, that's not true. These other countries actually think that they have interests at stake, and they're always pushing for what they want, whether we're there or not.
There's no doubt about it, and there I've noticed the same tendency over the years, and I think it tends to be spread on both sides of the political spectrum, among the far left and the very far right, that if only, as you say, if only America weren't there, everybody would just kind of calm down and behave themselves. I think that reveals a certain kind of narcissism in a particular streak of American foreign policy, because it seems to me that these are people who really believe that the whole rest of the world gets out of bed every morning saying, I don't know what to do today until I know what the United States is doing today. As though those countries don't have their own interests, they don't have their own leaders, they don't have their own peculiar cultures. It's a very American, solipsistic, self-absorbed view that says, everyone in the world depends on what we're doing and not on what they want. And I think the other part of that is, and this goes back to, if only we hadn't done X, if only we hadn't invaded Iraq, if only we hadn't gone to Vietnam, if only we hadn't been in Lebanon, whatever the particular foreign policy is that you don't like, there's also this kind of Homer Simpson belief of everything lasts forever. That if only we left things alone, that Saddam Hussein would live forever, that Syria would never have fallen. I was talking with a colleague the other day where we were trying to get our heads around why people think the Arab Spring was directly a result of the Iraq War. The Arab Spring, I mean, when the Arab Spring started to percolate in 2011, people who supported President Obama thought it was awesome. They said, see, this is, you know, the fruit of the 2009 speech and things.
They said it was from transparency. Yeah. Some people said it was from WikiLeaks.
Yes, exactly. That's quite right. And then when it all went bad and a new narrative had to be dreamed up, it was, well, it went bad and it's the Middle East. And in my simplistic view, all bad things in the Middle East get traced back to Iraq. So it must be that. When in fact, it's neither of those things. There, you can't put too much of this on President Obama or on President Bush, because, you know, people who live in the Middle East have lives and interests and beliefs and things they want too. And it's just
And the Syrian civil war, and you're hearing a lot of this now, by the way. People will say that the invasion of Iraq created ISIS, and or people will say that there wouldn't be the war in Syria wouldn't have happened if it weren't for some policy that that seems to ignore recent history in all of the countries, as you point out, of the Arab Spring, but just all the countries in the region. You know, there's a civil war going on in Yemen, and you know, they're very close to a civil war in Egypt, and there was a civil war in Libya. And I mean, this has been happening time and time again. And people that I know who are true Syria watchers, you know, who are not even just Arabists, but they're sort of Syrianists, if you will, they're people that this is what they study, have pointed out that the Assad regime, one of the main differences between Assad and some of these other governments is that they've been expecting this for a long time. They know that the Muslim Brotherhood was up and around Aleppo, stretching back to the days when Bashar al-Assad's father Hafez had to put down an uprising in Hama, and also had to deal with the Muslim Brotherhood in other parts of the country. These fault lines and fissures have existed for decades, and the Assad regime has been preparing for the day when they knew that they had that this was going to happen. They've been aware of this for a long time, but they were trying to suppress this Islamist tide.
And you know, I wish I could say that I coined this phrase, even though I use it a lot, but I wasn't smart enough to come up with this. But a columnist in Chicago years ago came up with a great expression that Americans have the historical awareness of tree squirrels, that we simply think that all history began, every person you talk to in the United States, I shouldn't say every, but most people you talk to in the United States think history began at the moment they started paying attention to it. That everything was fine in Syria up until a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And the fact of the matter is these autocratic regimes in the Middle East were headed for trouble one way or another. And the United States, the world has been characterized by waves of democratization, some more successful than others, since the 1950s. And this was, to some extent, this was inevitable. And the real question was, how was American foreign policy going to deal with some of these inevitable changes and try to shape them as best we could? And instead, because of the nature of this administration, we simply washed our hands of it and said, oh, you know, foreign policy is hard and it's difficult. There's nothing in it for us. And I was elected to not be George Bush, and that means never being involved in the Middle East. And so we're going to be involved, and then it goes wrong and we pull out, and then we go back in and we sort of mess around with the Egyptians, and then we turn our backs again. The inconsistency of this kind of foreign policy is making all of this much worse than it had to be. And bringing it back to what started our conversation, when American foreign policy is that weak and inconsistent, other powers will step in and fill the void. Unfortunately, countries like Russia and Turkey don't have a long post-World War II history of dealing with each other without some American involvement between them. And when left to their own devices, you know, these are two countries that by their nature don't like each other and don't get along with each other.
Right. I was actually talking about this yesterday, that I think it often escapes, and to your point about historical people's memories of history or their knowledge of history, it would be news to many people who think that they're very well informed on how the Bush foreign policy has destroyed the Middle East, that Russia and Turkey have been in each other's throats for centuries. Actually, they've been in each other's throats since before it was Turkey and since before it was Russia. So you know, this is not actually anything new.
These are the same people who worry about, you know, Russia and China, they're going to get together. You heard this a lot in the 1990s from the international relations academic specialists. They think like, well, you know, Russia and China are going to get together and they're going to form an alliance. They're going to counterbalance the United States and they're going to reach out to each other, totally ignoring the fact that the Russians and the Chinese on a very fundamental level really hate each other. And
yeah, you know, which makes it complicated for two powers to team up,
you know,
and be.
You know, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that was going to be the next Warsaw Pact. I remember there was a lot of concern about that and, you know, Putin's Eurasian space and all of that stuff. It totally, Americans, I think, have a tendency not to take culture, history, or ideological differences seriously because we don't. And so we just assume the rest of the world is like that. And then when something happens, we're always surprised. That's the part that just kills me, is that for the people who watch this part of the world, as you say, the Syria watchers, the Russian watchers, that the Turks and the Russians were going to butt heads in Syria at some point was one of the easiest calls. You couldn't have made money in Vegas off of that prediction because no bookie would have taken the bet that it was so easy.
Well, I think that's also one of the reasons that people tend to miss Putin's next moves and tend to underestimate or perhaps just misunderstand where he's going. And it's because, yeah, people say he's a thug, and we get that. And then Russia is kind of it's like a mafia state. And these statements are true, but they're very broad generalizations, and they also don't necessarily take into account that history and geography actually drive a lot of what Putin does. And that when you start to look at it from the perspective of what he's trying to accomplish, right, what he's trying to accomplish for himself and for Russia, he looks at things like Ukraine and he looks at the relationship with Turkey through a lens that is very different. In the West, we're like, what's the problem here? He sees a lot of problems that he would like to address.
I think the other problem, of course, is that we have a tendency to think that all foreign leaders, and even our own, depending on where you stand on American domestic politics, but we have a tendency to think that all leaders have a plan and that they know what they're doing and that, you know, Putin has a strategy or that this, and it makes me crazy talking to the strongest supporters of President Obama's foreign policy. They say, well, it's all part of a big tapestry that you're not really seeing. You know, sometimes people just aren't good at this. And that includes our leaders or foreign leaders. And foreign policy becomes triage. It's not a matter of always coming up with the optimal response or the perfect response. In foreign policy, the perfect is the enemy of the good. It may well be that Putin, as you say, he's caged by history, his own life experience as a Soviet KGB guy. There's certain things that he's just not going to overcome. But the notion, going back to what you said earlier, the notion that we just walk away and leave everybody alone, that they'll all kind of figure it out, is just crazy. That's not the way the world works.
I wish everybody had some sense, and it would be hard without being on the inside, of how active foreign intelligence services are from countries that are oppositional, if not straight up enemies of the United States, in countries all over the world that you would never even think they would care about. And they're, you know, they're propping up different people and they're paying off, you know, they're doing all kinds of stuff. And there's this whole game going on behind the scenes. It's not like America's the only one that sticks its finger into stuff that it's not supposed to be involved. But this is a, well, you know, this is a fun thing to say on college campuses and it'll get you applause on MSNBC. Tom, I can talk to you about this all day. We'll have you back again soon. Thank you. Tom Nichols of The Federalist. Do you have anything up right now, or what can we expect from you on The Federalist?
Well, I just did a review of Garry Kasparov's book on Russia, which
okay.
I highly recommend to your listeners.
We've had Garry on as a guest a bunch of times. Gary's great. So you can see Tom's latest, which is a review of Garry Kasparov's book. I think it's Winter is Coming, right?
Yes, Winter is Coming, correct.
Winter is Coming. All right. Read Tom's review at TheFederalist.com. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you, Buck.
All right, guys, much more coming, and gals, much more coming up in just a second. I'll be right back.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Discover more at theblaze.com/radio.
The Blaze Radio Network.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
In the break, so I'll give Jason in D.C. the floor. Jason, you got 60 seconds to do your Jason thing. Go for it.
Hey, we should be up in arms right now. The administration let one of the worst spies in history, Jonathan Pollard, who was spying for Israel, out of jail. And when people talk about Bergdahl and all of these other people, Pollard, Caspar Weinberger, described as one of the worst U.S. espionage acts in history, and we let him out of jail to appease Israel. This is a crime. This is crazy. This is a guy that should have been executed.
Wow. All right. Look, I agree with you on the gravity of Pollard's crimes. Based on everything that I know, he tried to give away the most sensitive stuff he could possibly find, and specifically do it in a way that would be harmful to U.S. national security. I don't know why he's being let out of jail.
It's to appease Israel because of the whole Iranian arms deal.
I mean, I know what the reasons people give are, but I wouldn't have done it.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network. Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. I wanted to talk some politics now with you just to get us all on the same page before we go off and eat some turkey and cranberry sauce. And my mom does really good the sweet potatoes, sort of mashed sweet potatoes with the, marshmallow on top, which you can just put on anything and it tastes good. I mean, you could put that on, like, a tire, and then you'd want to eat the tire. That's a little aggressive, but you get the idea. But I wanted to put us all on the same page with politics so we're not missing anything. We come back, we hit the ground running. So to run down through all that with us, we've got Guy Benson now. He's the townhall.com political editor, and he's also a Fox News contributor. Guy, always good to hear from you, buddy. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving.
So I'm seeing this poll linked with Drudge, and happy Thanksgiving to you, sir, by the way. I'm seeing this poll linked with Drudge, linked to the Drudge Report right now from Reuters. It's a 5-day poll. It has Donald Trump at 38%. Now, maybe this isn't the most scientific poll or the greatest poll or whatever. It's a Reuters poll that's linked on the Drudge Report right now. You got Ted Cruz at 11, Ben Carson at 11, Mark Rubio at 8, and then some other stuff. Guy, I just want to ask you, for all of us who are conservatives and who, no matter what, are going to find themselves voting for somebody within the GOP, is it time to get a Make America Great Again hat and keep it in the closet just in case? I mean, what do you think about all this?
Well, I think the Reuters polls have been, especially their tracking poll, has been, I mean, just a total outlier the entire cycle. So that's a junk number. Trump is definitely leading nationally. He's not leading 38% to his closest competitor at 11. That's all the other polling shows it much tighter than that, with Rubio and Ted Cruz really gaining, and I think we're starting to see Ben Carson fading a little bit, although Carson is still in second place. So your question, the premise of your question is the same, which is it possible that Donald Trump's going to be the nominee? And I thought that was an unfathomable eventuality even a number of months ago. And I know there are a lot of people who still say it's not going to happen, has no chance of happening. I think it's very difficult to look at the national polling, even if you throw out the Reuters poll, which I think you should. You look at the national polling, you look at a lot of state-level polling. Donald Trump is tied or leading in basically every single state at this point, and he has been for months. So I think that you're in denial if you look at those numbers and think that they're meaningless. I am intrigued by the new Quinnipiac poll, which is a more reliable pollster out of Iowa that has Ted Cruz basically pulling into a tie with Donald Trump. And it'll be very interesting to see how Trump and Cruz interact, because they've sort of been playing sort of a footsie for a long time and seemingly engaged in a non-aggression pact. But if they're going to be, you know, locked in a tie atop the first state, I think you're going to start to see some fists fly.
Huh. What do you make of this piece in the Washington Post that says that the big GOP donors at this point have the only strategy they have with regard to Trump is a kind of non-strategy, or a strategy of wait and see, sit back and pray, because all of the efforts that have been put out there to try to undermine Trump, I mean, it's amazing. It's like his superpower is the crazier things get and the more people come after him, the stronger he gets, which I guess isn't like the blob. The more that it takes in, the bigger it gets, and the more you come after it, the bigger it gets. Anyway, it seems like there's nothing they can do to stop the Trump momentum, such as it were. And now people are starting to feel like, well, Iowa, I guess, maybe, but he's doing well in Iowa.
Yeah, but it's a very luxurious blob. It's a very classy blob. You'll love it.
Right, the classiest. It is huge, too.
It's a huge, the blob gets huger and huger, and people love it. People love the blob, believe me. Look, the piece in the Washington Post is fascinating, because essentially what it says is plan A for major Republican donors is to wait for Trump to implode. Plan B is non-existent. they've got nothing. And, I mean, it is true that the rules of political gravity don't apply to Donald Trump, at least within the Republican primary. That's what I keep reminding people, because, you know, he says things almost every couple days that to a normal candidate, in normal circumstances, would virtually end that person's campaign. You know, for example, likening Ben Carson to a pedophile repeatedly. That, you know, that is something that usually a candidate couldn't get over, you know, get past. The 9/11 fantasy memories about thousands of people cheering in New Jersey, that never happened. I mean, the list sort of, you know, the whole controversy over the Muslim registry, which finally got cleared up last night. I mean, it's sort of one thing after another, saying that the Black Lives Matter protester deserved to be roughed up when he heckled at a rally. I mean, it's none of these things really hurt him within the Republican primary, because there is such an intense strain of loathing for the political class that Trump's core supporters, about 25% of the Republican electorate, have dug in their heels, and they've decided, sort of like Obama supporters, you know, the hardcore Obama supporters, nothing the man says or does will impact their unflinching loyalty to him. I mean, it's very Obama-esque in that sense. And so with a fractured field, 25% or thereabouts, anywhere between 20 and 30%, could very well be enough to win, you know, any number of states, and that will especially matter once you get into winner-take-all territory in March. So, and of course, March is a long way off. There's a big caveat there, you know, with the asterisk. No votes have been cast yet, and no votes will be cast until February. Regardless of all of that, I think that it's, you know, it is important to look at the numbers within the Republican primary and then also look at the numbers within a general election setting where Donald Trump's favorability rating has taken a massive hit and remains now very low among overall voters, the people who will actually pick the president come next fall. His favorability rating is the lowest of either party in the entire field, including Hillary Clinton, and her numbers are pretty bad.
All right. Well, there's something then to be hopeful about, something to be thankful for maybe as we go to Thanksgiving. Guy Benson, politics editor over at townhall.com. You should all go check out his latest there. Also, you'll be seeing him on Fox News where he's a contributor. Guy, thank you for calling in.
Thank you, friend. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. You too. To those of you out there, I'm not sure if your audio situation was the same as mine. I know it sort of sounded like Guy was coming in and out of a submarine there for a second. So, but, you know, his analysis, was that the case, Ty? Yeah. His analysis is excellent. So even Guy Benson calling in from a submarine is worth listening to. But for those of you that had to strain a little bit there, I'm sorry about that. This is, you know, one of the dangers of radio. I always, you know, cell phones. Come on, cell phones. You got to sound a little bit better for me than you do sometimes. On this issue of Trump, though, I got to say, look, there's a lot to talk about here, and I won't belabor it all because there are other things I want to move on to. But when it comes to Trump, this is reality now, everybody. I mean, he's winning, he's leading, and unfortunately, even though he's winning and doing well among Republicans, the trends at the national level against the Democrat, against Hillary Clinton, are really bad. And I know Trump supporters say, oh, forget about it, you know, Trump, and, you know, he fights and everything else. But, wow, if Hillary Clinton wins because Donald Trump is the nominee for the Republicans, that will be very, very sad indeed. And I think there's a real possibility that that's what's going to happen here. Man, it is. And for somebody who has to go on, or as I should say, I shouldn't say has to, somebody who goes on television and is occasionally put in the position of having to speak for the conservative side of the aisle, speak for the Republican side of the aisle in some capacity. Trump and Carson haven't been making it that easy recently. Oh, look, I'm just telling you, you know, I get a view of what's going on the other side, how the left thinks about things, how they're approaching it. And all I can tell you is, you'll see, they love to cover Donald Trump. Love it, love it, love it. And you might think to yourself, oh, well, he's a Republican frontrunner, so that's why they're doing it. Or, oh, he's good TV. That's some of it. But there's another part of it, too. And it's one that I think is essential that you not ignore. And that is that they recognize and people understand, people in the media understand, that perceptions are being formed right now. And the election is going to come down to a few million votes in a handful of states cast by people who are undecided or independents, or that's going to be the deciding factor. I mean, you could say turnout, I know, but, well, unless Donald Trump is going to make a whole lot of conservative voters appear who have never voted before, I think that that's unlikely. So it's going to come down to, at least it has in the past, a few states and a few million votes. And there are a lot of people in the media who see this as an attempt to really create or bolster an image of the Republican Party as a bunch of, look, their narrative is that the Republican Party is a bunch of blustery white male racists who are xenophobes and et cetera, et cetera. And this is why it's tough for those of us who go on TV. And I would like to talk about how Obamacare exchanges are failing and how the health care is crap and how people's premiums are going up and how we haven't even seen the individual mandate happen. I would like to talk about how the border is not secure. I would like to talk about Obama's failed foreign policy in Syria and across the Middle East, which has in no small part led to the exacerbation of the refugee crisis that now threatens the heart of Europe itself. I would like to talk about the inability of the Obama administration to degrade and defeat ISIS, or not even inability, its unwillingness to do what is necessary and to be serious. These are the things that I would like to talk about. And not just me. I'm speaking for now the, I shouldn't say I'm speaking for them, right? But I'm referring to those of us who try to get the message out there and try to fight the good fight. And we're constantly, this is how every conversation starts out. As soon as you're outside of conservative media, every conversation starts out with, Donald Trump said this crazy thing, defend it. And you could say to yourself, yeah, Buck, but anti-PC, whatever. Okay, that might work with conservatives, but is it going to work in a general election? Maybe I'm wrong. Been wrong before. It's not, you know, it's not terrorism. Tend to be right on that. So maybe I'm wrong on this, but it, I'm just saying, it doesn't make a job easy. 888-900-3393 on our lines here. I would very much like to hear from some of you. If you have any thoughts on Thanksgiving, if you have some tales from your own Thanksgiving table, either in the recent or distant past, we could do a little Thanksgiving chat here. I feel like that would be kind of fun. Maybe we'll tell some Thanksgiving stories on the flip side. 888-900-3393. Oh, also, I posted a bunch of clips from CNN on questions of Islamophobia and questions of Islamic values and versus American values. I would recommend, if you get a moment, you check them out. There's some pretty interesting exchanges, if I do say so myself, with a New York Times columnist, Charles Blow, and also Mark Lamont Hill, who I believe is a Huffington Post host. So that's on Facebook.com/Buck Sexton. The video clips are there. So go check it out. Like the page, click play, and enjoy. I'll be back in just a minute.
Buck Sexton, dispensing the truth.
On the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton Show.
All right, team, we got some calls coming in. We have Lori in New Jersey. Lori, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Buckman, how are you doing?
Good. Hey, Lori, what's up?
A couple things have happened this week that have given us some glimpses into the fact that some of the people carrying out these heinous Islamist attacks are actually not very religious. So, for example, the woman who blew herself up in Paris in the raid that I think was Monday morning was not apparently religious, not a reader of the Quran. There were a bunch of pictures of her, social media pictures, I guess, behaving like your average Westerner, if you will. Then last night on Glenn's show, he had the segment about Father Douglas, and Father Douglas tells the story about the thugs who abducted him, basically being like, as he described, as big babies. Very kind of just not exactly committed, but seeming not to have anything else to do with their lives. Now, not that this is any excuse for anything, but what extent do you think this is going on in the ranks of the Islamists? How many of them are just duped?
Well, you know, I think that a way to maybe put this into some kind of a context is think about it in as though we're talking about a death cult of some kind, which is what this sort of sliver, this jihadist philosophy, this part of the broader a broader Islamic philosophy, right? I mean, this is one component of it. This is one, and maybe one day we could have a discussion about all the schismatic belief systems within Islam and what we could talk about Baha'i, we could talk about Tijaniyya Islam, we could talk about Hojataya Islam, we could talk about Sufism, we could talk about all those things. But jihadism is certainly a part of it, and it's no small part of it. It's actually a very prominent, and some would argue it's sort of the tip of the spear, and it's the kind of vanguard of the broader Islamic community, whether they want that to be the case or not, right? I mean, you go back to I saw it was just a few nights ago, actually, Neil Ferguson, who's a brilliant historian, a really interesting guy, British guy, and he was on CNN, and he was talking about the Russian Revolution, which I have to say, I've talked to you here before about this. Keep in mind that the Stalinists who took over, and of course, at the time, they weren't Stalinists, they were just sort of, they thought they were classic Marxist revolutionaries, and later on, Stalin seizes power, and they become Stalinists, but that they were, the Reds in that context, were a small minority. And people didn't think that this was going to go very far. And there was a much broader conversation happening of socialists and socialism all across the European continent and really all across the Western world. And they were able to seize control. And as we know, the Soviet Union, and took us to the brink of nuclear war and everything else. So sometimes the potency of the idea matters much more than the prevalence of the idea. That's one thought, Lori. And the other is, if you want to think about this as a death cult, the people at the top probably at some level either believe or are good enough at faking belief that they can inspire belief in others. And sometimes there are people who will join some kind of an insane cult that will either literally drink the Kool-Aid and they all die, or it will, they think that it's the end of the world and they'll kill themselves or do something else. And they are listless and they don't have a, but all of a sudden they decide to do this, right? All of a sudden they believe in this figurehead who's promising them purpose and promising them an afterlife or promising them whatever it may be. So I think that you think of it like a death cult, and that these are cultists who are joining. And that's why radicalization is so hard to detect and to prevent, because it can happen very quickly. But belief is still a precondition. But they have to, you have to believe in something to show up in Syria and think that this is a good idea, right? I mean, no, it is irrational to think, or rather in the case of this woman, it is irrational to think that strapping a suicide vest and being a part of killing a whole bunch of people is, you know, it is irrational to think that will bring you anything except misery and pain, unless at some level you buy into this idea of jihad. Is that, am I kind of getting at what your point was?
Yeah,
I know I.
It is all very interesting. It's all very relevant. I guess I'm just, you know, the pictures of that woman sitting in the bathtub and what have you really struck me as being, you know what, you were just so bored, this was all you could think of to do with your life, and strap on a suicide vest for your cousin. I mean, it's very sort of weird, but I get where you're going. Could I make one more comment on the playground that has become the border between Syria and Turkey?
I'm sorry, Laurie, I missed the beginning of the question. What was that?
Oh, I just wanted to see if I could make one more comment about the playground that we have between Syria and Turkey. And
sure, we're going to a break in 60 seconds, but go ahead.
No problem. You know, I, for one, am not at least a little bit interested in playing schoolyard monitor for the Russians and the Turks who want to shoot at each other over a real or imagined war infraction. On the other hand, I'm very interested in going in there and doing away with ISIS. Is there a way the U.S. can separate those roles, or do we have to continuously be the schoolyard monitor?
I think we got to do both. I'll be honest with you. I think that there's, because Turkish equities, as they say inside of government, we always refer to people's equities, right? Turkish equities, I'm not even sure it's the proper usage of the word, but this is how people speak about it. And Russian equities in Syria are not just different, but at cross purposes in many ways. And so are ours with theirs at some level. And so this is the complexities of this proxy fight, that you have to make sure that you're not blowing up the wrong planes or getting yourself into a shooting war with a major power. Back in a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Team, I have kind of an update from yesterday. The second pilot in the Russian plane that was shot down is alive, and he's actually back in. Let me see what we have. This is from CNN. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said on his Twitter feed, this is how people find out what's going on in the world these days, that the country would deploy S-400 missile systems near Latakia, which have a range of 155 miles, and the Turkish border is 30 miles away. Ooh. Oh, my. And Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told Russian TV on Wednesday that Russia has serious doubts that Turkey's downing of its warplane was a, quote, unpremeditated act. Lavrov says it looks very much like a planned provocation. And Turkish President Erdogan, remember G's are kind of pronounced like W's from what I know in Turkish, and the C with a little weird mark under it, like it looks like Incirlik, it's Injirlik, it's like a J. So that's about the extent of my Turkish language knowledge. But he said that it was a violation of Turkish airspace by Russian warplanes, and he's charged Russia with propping up the Assad regime, which, well, that's obviously true. But they're all. You also have the pilot in this case. The second pilot says that, I'm just trying to make sure here. Yeah, the rescued co-pilot, Konstantin Morokhtin, has told reporters that there were no warnings, not via the radio, not visually. So he's saying the Turks just shot him down. Now, of course, that makes sense, right, from the perspective of what are you supposed to say if you're the Russian pilot in this case? This is a very fraught and tense moment in relations between these countries and in the broader context of what's going to happen here in Syria and surrounding Syria, surrounding this just black hole of a conflict that just keeps getting worse, by the way. There's no signs of anything really stabilizing or getting better. It keeps getting worse all the time. But this, you do have a NATO member shooting down a Russian warplane. And now there's, of course, a dispute as to whether there were warnings given. So as you can imagine, this is going to get very, very heated. And if the Russians do put this missile system in northern Syria, think about what that means now. By the way, our whole notion of a no-fly zone, the only way we could do that now would be with Russian acceptance. So by Russia taking the initiative here and putting real forces on the ground in Syria by emplacing artillery, by flying airstrikes. And remember, they're flying airstrikes and they're basing out of Syria. So their time to target is real fast. They're right there. They're flying airstrikes in Syria and they might put up this S-400 missile system, which would give them a 155-mile range, according to missilethreat.com, which I don't know. I guess that's believable. That's what they have quoted here. But that would be a more advanced system, I would assume, than the S-300, which was something that we're worried would be deployed in Iran. So that changes right there. You've got a bit of a game changer with regard to what we could do with a no-fly zone, with how active our airstrikes could be, because we're going to put planes not only in airspace where there are Russian fighters going on, but you're also going to now have planes that are subject to being radar locked by an advanced Russian surface-to-air missile system. Think about this. And now I want to know, by the way, how long do you think it is before the Russians go, whoopsie, and shoot a Turkish plane out of the sky? Remember, the Turks have been flying some airstrikes, not against the Islamic State, because no, not that. You know, Turkey is this model of secular progress for the Islamic world. No, they're trying to blow up YPG militia units. That's what they've been going after. How long do you think it is before all of a sudden Putin's guys have a little whoopsie and blow a Turkish fighter plane out of the sky with one of these surface-to-air missiles, if they in fact put them in Syria? Anyone want to put bets on that one? And you already know what the Russian script is going to be should that happen, right? The Russians will come out and be like, you know, sorry, it's very complicated, lot of plane in sky, it's very, it's the middle of war, it's tough, and I told Yuri, and Yuri told Oleg, and Oleg was like, wait, for real? So, yeah, you could see where the Russians go with this all of a sudden, and think about the level of tensions that would be ratcheted up at that point. So we do have some follow-on from yesterday with the fact that the second pilot is already back in Russian hands, and he's now, of course, being used as a propaganda tool for the Russian state to say that the Turks did not in any way warn, and they just shot a Russian warplane out of the sky. And now the Russians are saying, okay, well, guess what we're going to do? And they're going to put that missile system there, and this gets very interesting now. And this is why also, by the way, this notion, and the Obama administration constantly operates under this notion, that timing doesn't matter. When in fact, in conflict, in many cases, timing is the only thing that matters. Timing matters more than anything else. Seizing the initiative, being ahead of your enemy, foreseeing his next steps. These are things, you know, this is like Sun Tzu stuff. I mean, this is, you can go way back to the origins of warfare. And when you do something matters oftentimes as much, if not more, than how you do the thing, right? This is we're kicking it old school here. But the idea that somehow the Obama administration can wait around and take years and years to figure out what the strategy will be here, and there won't be events on the ground and, as we see, in the sky that are changing that reality, I mean, this is just a fallacy. There's no way. By the time President Obama wants to put, even if he did want to put, and I don't think he does, by the way, I don't foresee And I really hope that this is not, my theory here is not tested, because it would mean that we had been hit. But I wouldn't foresee Obama putting large numbers, and by large numbers, I mean, you know, brigade strength, you know, a few brigades. But I don't see the president doing that, even if we had a pretty significant terrorist attack on U.S. soil. I mean, it would have to be catastrophic. Even though the calls from the American public are already getting very loud for a greater action in Syria, and the polls I'm seeing are over 60% want us to do something more substantial in Syria than what we've already done. But I think if we got ahead and we took, and again, I hope I'm wrong on this, and that all this threat reporting is nothing, and that we're fine. But you know, if we took 10 or 15 casualties, 10 or 15 killed in a terrorist act here on U.S. soil, which would be the biggest one we've seen in quite a while, I'm not sure Obama all of a sudden is dropping the 82nd Airborne and putting in a Marine Expeditionary Unit and really going for it in Raqqa. I don't think that happens. I think the president is obstinate on this issue. He is absolutely set on making sure that he isn't, because remember, the whole narrative, and this is part of what was so interesting about talking to Tom before about the sort of the views of foreign policy that prevail in certain quarters, particularly among people who think of themselves as very worldly and very knowledgeable. This is the most facile explanation for complex events, that basically Bush ruined everything. You know, that the invasion of Iraq did all this bad stuff that wasn't happening before. Apparently they have no familiarity with the Middle East and what it's been like in recent decades. You know, not particularly up on one of the longest declared wars of the 20th century, the Iran-Iraq War, which went on for about 9 years, killed like a million people, massive deployments of chemical weapons. You had minefields being cleared by martyr volunteers, by Shahid volunteers, whole units, military units created of people whose only job was to walk into a minefield to clear it because they were worth less than the tanks. And that was the Iran-Iraq War. That was back in the 80s. You know, we don't really think much about this stuff now. We don't really hear much about it. But the idea that somehow this is all destabilized because of Bush is crazy. It is. It's actually, by the way, it was the 20th century's longest conventional war. So I said it was one of the, it is the longest conventional war of the 20th century, is the Iran-Iraq War. And it was a horrific, but this is just, again, it's so easy to say Bush ruined everything, and this is why, you know, Bush lied, babies died, and the left believes this. And it's the same people who think that everything that's going wrong over there is the fault of U.S. foreign policy or U.S. intervention. If only we were that powerful. Because if we were that powerful, then we could just have better policies and fix everything, right? But that's not the case. With President Obama, you've seen somebody who thinks that the solution to most problems in the Middle East is for the U.S. to just stand back and watch it happen. And this has led directly to the European migrant immigrant crisis now, and also the recognition, I think, in the West that we have allowed the Al-Qaeda Afghanistan model to replicate itself, but this time in the Levant, right on the Mediterranean, much closer to the heart of Europe. And it's like we've learned nothing from that experience. We can just sort of sit back and hope that all of this will go away. But back to the timing, I know I'm bouncing around here, but back to timing and how the timing of all this should matter. Think about what it will be like in 3 or 6 months on the ground there right now. Russia is getting more and more involved. You've got the Iranians who, by the way, feel like they have carte blanche to do pretty much whatever they want now in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East. They know that, what sticks do we have? What are we going to do? What counteractions are we going to take under this administration in the last year of his presidency? And there's a bunch of reasons why I think they're going to be particularly ineffective, why this White House is going to be particularly ineffective on foreign policy. There is the legacy issue, and it's hard to overstate what seems to be a megalomaniacal ego when it comes to President Obama. It's hard to overstate just how invested in the greatness of Obama actually is. But then when you add on to that the need to preserve a certain kind of legacy and preserve a certain level of public support for the Obama administration, in order for the Hillary campaign to have a real shot, then I think you're starting to see that we are just going to be sitting on our hands. And I know there's something between 150,000 U.S. troops trying to rebuild a country from scratch and do nothing. Don't believe those who go out there and say, oh, another. There are other things that can be done and can be done better than they've been done recently by the administration, whether it's airstrikes, training of indigenous forces, building an actual coalition of allies. And then there's just the very simple and straightforward stuff, like your word should mean something. Drawing a red line should mean something. I mean, this is all diplomacy and foreign policy and national security 101, and the Obama White House has failed on those issues very, very dramatically. I think you could say has failed in spectacular fashion. But nonetheless, here we are. It's also never mentioned by the blame Bush for everything crowd that in 2009, Iraq was in a sustainable and defensible position, and it was a democracy, and there were elections that had happened, and it was paying its bills, and with oil money. That's all, and it had defeated a massive jihadist insurgency. By the way, it started out as a sort of anti-American, colonial insurgency. That's sort of the rhetoric that was used, and you had imbeciles like Michael Moore comparing suicide bombers who were killing Iraqis along with American and coalition troops who were trying to do horrible things like turn the lights on and give them indoor plumbing, you know, let them get to school and build schools for them. Oh, heavens, no. But that was all then very quickly consumed by jihadist hatred. And AQI became the umbrella insurgency group that took all these other groups under its wing. And then it was just the death cult, the same death cult we see with the Islamic State. AQI is the Islamic State. They're the same thing. We should talk more in depth about Iraq another time. I've got so many of you listening I know who served over there, and I always encourage any of you, whenever we're talking about this, to call in and just, if you want to share some of your thoughts from your own experience trying to rebuild that country or just your thoughts from your service, you are always welcome to call in. I don't care what we're talking about here. All right, we'll take a break. Back in just a minute.
Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network. Listening to the Buck Sexton Show.
So, team, you know, it's the holidays, and sometimes people like me start to think about, you know, what would be one way to deal with the cold. And so I had the idea a couple of days ago, an idea that lasted for maybe an hour or two. I was like, you know, maybe I should grow a beard. I was thinking about it. And then I realized I went back into the memory banks. I was like, no, if I don't shave for very long, if I go too long, rather, without shaving, I look like, first of all, I grow like a red and brown sort of mess of a beard. It's like some hairs are bright red and some are brown and just looks a little scraggly. And then I look like a kid who's trying to buy beer at the deli or something. You know, it's just a beard is probably not the option for me. But I got this from one of my producers here on things that we're grateful for. And I think this is tongue in cheek. There's now a trend among the bearded, among gentlemen with beards, and I'm sure many of you listening fall into the bearded category. This is an Instagram trend, and it's catching on for the holidays. Glitter beards, where people are putting glitter in their beards as a show of holiday spirit. So, you know, you turn your beard into like, you make it sort of golden colored or green and red. This has become a thing on Instagram. So while I still think that I probably am not going to go the full beard route just for me, again, because I don't think a beard on me will do anything other than make me look like a teenager who's trying to buy alcohol, I do think that glitter beards that's new. That's not something I had expected to be a holiday trend. So if for some reason you go with the glitter beard, post it on Facebook. Let's see it. Back in a minute.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.
now, spreading freedom across the nation. This is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to Hour 3 today in the Freedom Hut. Sort of a Buck Wild pre-Thanksgiving Wednesday. So the phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. Do give a call. I want to talk a bit about immigrant stuff for a few minutes here. Specifically Muslim immigrants and the debate surrounding all this recently. I was on CNN earlier in the week, and it was sort of a segment split in two. I had nothing to do with this part of the segment, but the mayor of Hamtramck, I think I'm saying that right, the mayor of Hamtramck was on, and she has the distinction of being the mayor of the first town in America that has a predominantly Muslim Muslim city council, and it's also a near Muslim majority city. It's 40%. It's not a majority yet, but it's 40% of Hamtramck is Muslim, and so there's a lot of discussion now about what that's like. And they brought on this mayor from Hamtramck, and of course, there's this constant Islamophobia watch that's going on right now. Right, everyone's concerned and worried that there will be, you know, that there'll be bouts of anti-Islamic bigotry out there, and this is what the media is focusing on. In the aftermath of a major terrorist attack in Paris by jihadists, I think, and I've made this very clear to you and on this show and elsewhere, that I think that that's a very strange focus to immediately have when the security risks are as high as they are. Actually, wait, hold on a second. Do we have a President Obama clip? Let's play this real quick. We got President Obama saying, don't worry about it, we've got this, right? Play that clip.
I want the American people to know, entering the holidays, that the combined resources of our military, our intelligence, and our homeland security agencies are on the case. They're vigilant, relentless, and effective. As we go into Thanksgiving weekend, I want the American people to know is that we are taking every possible step to keep our homeland safe. In the event of a specific credible threat, the public will be informed. So as Americans travel this weekend to be with their loved ones, I want them to know that our counterterrorism, intelligence, homeland security, and law enforcement professionals at every level are working overtime. They are continually monitoring threats at home and abroad.
All right. You know, just because Obama says it doesn't make it false or doesn't make it wrong. So, yeah, that's kind of what I expected him to say. And you know, take it for what it is. It's kind of what I was telling you, which is, look, if there was a credible specific threat, they would actually tell the public about it. They might act on it immediately and tell the public about it, meaning they would try to break up a cell. But, you know, there's not this. I think there's always this rumor out there that there's some secret place where the real attack information or the real threat information is stored, and only a few people have access to it. And even if they think that something horrible is going to happen, they're not going to tell it. That's not how it goes. The reality is actually you've got huge, you've got armies worth of people in terms of the numbers. You've got huge, vast, you know, just think of it like cube farm after cube farm of analysts for all the different alphabet soup of intel and security agencies. And they're just going through reams and reams and reams and reams of threat information and intercepts and everything all day long. So if there's something really pressing that is obvious, they'll do something about it. All right. So Obama says, enjoy your holiday. All right. With that, I'll say the same thing. Go out there and do what you got to do. Enjoy your holiday with your family. Okay. So back to Hamtramck. That was just before I think that was right when we came on air, right before Obama was out there doing his Obama thing. Okay. Hamtramck, Muslim majority city council. And there's some interesting stories that have been written about this now, because Hamtramck is a city. Where is this? This is in Michigan, right? I forget. Yeah, it's in Michigan. And Michigan, of course, is already well known for having a very large and politically active Muslim population in Dearborn. But Hamtramck is a place that's known traditionally as having a large Polish-American population, and this city is changing. It's changing pretty quickly. And I think it was the New York Times or the Washington Post earlier in the week that had a whole piece on what that has meant. And there is some unease with not just this is what's always interesting to me. The assumption is, oh, you must be a racist or an Islamophobe. And by the way, those two things should never be there. Even if you believe that direct and straightforward disdain for Islam as a religion, even if you believe that that's Islamophobia, right, which is a whole separate. I think that we should have a discussion here someday. Today's not the day. I just don't have the I don't have it in me for today. But I always find it fascinating that we're all supposed to pretend that disparate religious faiths have. It's one thing to respect the person and their rights as a human being and as a citizen or as a, you know, just as a fellow human being, but that you have to respect their beliefs. Why would I respect somebody else? If you're a believing, fill in the blank, it doesn't have to, you're believing any, you know, if you're believing Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, Jew, and why would you, and this is true of, you see what I'm saying? There's a distinction here. Nobody ever wants to talk about this, and I find it fascinating that you think that all that other, you inherently think that that other stuff is not real or is not the truth in a religious sense, but you're supposed to respect it. I mean, you allowing somebody else to respect it, yeah, fine. You have to respect it? You have to sit around and say that you... Is that what is required of us, by the way? Am I required to believe? Is a Christian required to believe and show respect for the belief that a 7th century Arabian warlord had a dictation over a series of events from the angel Gabriel, who dictated to him in Arabic, apparently, what the true word of God, I'm supposed to, what exactly? No, I don't think this is an idle question. It's one that doesn't get very much attention. People could say, well, you don't want to denigrate somebody else's beliefs because that's inherently going to be inflammatory and cause discord. Okay, well, you know, not saying denigrate, but I've got to be like, yeah, I respect that interpretation. That sounds about right to me. I'm gonna go with yes on that. And somebody could turn around and say, oh, well, you know, you believe that a Jewish preacher and leader was crucified and came back from the dead and everything else. Well, if I'm a Christian, yeah, actually. But that doesn't mean I believe all the other stuff, right? It doesn't mean that I sit around saying, oh, yeah, you know, Buddha and Muhammad and, yeah, it's all the... This is one of the bizarre, I shouldn't say legacies, one of the bizarre effects of this sort of multicultural and sort of diversity brainwashing that you're supposed to not just remember. I'm not saying that you wouldn't allow somebody else to have their beliefs. No, of course not. Right? People are free to have their own beliefs about the meaning of life and about the afterlife and everything else. That's different than saying I have to show respect for the belief in the sense that what I think it's true. I quite obviously don't think it's true. So am I not allowed to say that? Am I not supposed to say that? Why? Maybe I'm going down a path here that we shouldn't right now, but I always think that's very interesting to me. Anyway, back to Hamtramck and the Muslim community. And this is, you know, people will say to me, and I've been in a series of discussions on TV this week on CNN about Islam, and I'll get some tweet. Of course, some just people are hateful, and I love it when somebody's response to what I'm saying about jihadist philosophy and the threat that opposes the world is like they hate my face and you know, I look like a clown or whatever. I mean, there's always those people just are inherently idiots, but you get a lot of that. But even some other people sort of say to me, you know, you're being offensive towards a religion. I think that's a very interesting and actually very ominous point. What does it mean being offensive towards a religion? I don't believe in the doctrines of other religions. I don't believe that it's true. So am I supposed to sit back and act like I do? If somebody asks me, if somebody says, well, you know, do you believe that the angel or the archangel Gabriel dictated the Quran to Muhammad in the 7th century deserts of Arabia? My answer to that is no. I don't believe. And that's this shouldn't be a shock or a surprise, but if you really think about it in the current context, people think that that's offensive. You know, this is a weird thing that we've got going on here. I'm not saying that means that I should walk into a mosque and yell this, and that would be a really bad idea, obviously, right? You know, religion of peace, we'll see how long that lasts. But the point is, I'm not allowed to say that? I'm supposed to say that, oh yeah, I believe in all that? Really? Where does it end? Do I believe in Ganesh as well? Or do I... What other faith traditions do I have to sort of bow and show respect to, as though I think that this is worthy of my respect? I don't know how else to put it. Worthy of my respect. I'm just wondering where else the lines are drawn. Anyway, and as I pointed out to you, the White House tweets out Happy Ramadan. I have yet to see them tweet out anything about the, you know, Happy Hindu festival or Buddhist festival. And there are as many Buddhists in this country as there are Muslims, and there are almost as many Hindus as there are Muslims. But yet, so what? We have a preference for, the White House has a stated preference for monotheism? Is that where we are? I know I'm being a little provocative here. Oh, it's the day before Thanksgiving, and we should probably be focused on our mashed potatoes and turkey and sweet potatoes. Love the sweet potatoes. And other yummy morsels and such, and that's going to be important. But maybe I'm giving you something to get a little fire started at the dinner table, at the Thanksgiving table. Think about this one a little bit. Think about this. What is it exactly? Where is the line drawn between your allowing somebody else their religious beliefs and not infringing on their rights and their beliefs, and you having to sort of show deference to their beliefs? And Islam is particularly problematic in this context because it's really the only one that I can think of that right now tells you that you better show respect or else. Even if you're a non-believer. Never mind if you're from within the faith and then you're an apostate and then you've got the, you know, Ayaan Hirsi Ali situation where you leave the faith and you're under threat for the rest of your life. But even if you're a non-believer, you're not supposed to show depictions of the Prophet, for example, if you're a non-believer. Why is that? Why would I make that concession? Oh, you don't want to give offense. Well, where else does that stop? Where else does that lead us? You know, is it giving offense if I'm a woman and I walk around in a skirt? Is it giving offense? You know, I'd like to know. If I'm a guy and I'm walking around without a long beard, we were talking about beards before. What about a glitter beard, by the way? I'm guessing not okay under Sharia. Red henna beard, actually sign of your erudite religious status within Islam. Just putting that out there. No glitter beards, but red henna? Yes, yes indeed. I kind of got sidetracked from Hamtramck here because we are just rolling with it. But I'll come back to it in a minute, so stay with me.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network. Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
All right, team, the lines are open. 888-900-3393. David in Boston, welcome to the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, thanks, Buck. Interesting topic. Certainly is something we're going to be struggling with for a while now. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the connection between the liberal left socialists and Islam, because I think they're pretty much of the same mindset in terms of how to organize society. And the reason why I say that is because Islam is defined submission, and socialism is defined control. And so you see the socialists looking for every possible way to stir up a social problem so they can control society. And you see the Muslim population, at least the leaders, looking for every way they can sort of work out submission on the part of the people that they rule over. And for the population that agrees that they want to be Muslim or belong to Islam, then they volunteered for that, and that's their worldview. They look at the Quran, they say, well, it's inevitable that according to Allah and Muhammad, that the whole planet is going to be submissive to God in that way. And then the socialists, of course, you know, starting throughout 20th century history, have all had their own versions of that, looking for that kind of thing. So now when you have the liberals siding with Islam in a way, basically because they see things from that same kind of perspective, the worldview of we better get mankind under control. You know, we got to make sure everybody follows our leadership, and we're going to make things up as we go along. So they invent an awful lot of authoritative stuff to see how they can, you know, leverage us into doing what they want.
Well, you know, power and control are intoxicating things for many people, even if they're not necessarily the ones making the decisions. People like to be a part of the side that is, right? There's a sense of joining whoever is going to be in control, whoever's going to be in power. And this has been true of political movements and religious movements throughout history, right? You might as well join the winning side, so to speak. And in the context of modern nation states in the 21st century, the winning side, for many people, they view it as sort of the statist side, the side of the state, because states are very powerful and very involved in our day-to-day lives in a way that was unthinkable before. I always point this out. I feel like nobody seems to care about this as much as I do. You know, the founding fathers were worried about intrusion into our lives when it took like 10 days or whatever it was to get a letter from Boston to D.C. I mean, they were worried about it then. You know, now here we are with a massive federal bureaucracy that puts out enormous reams of regulations that have the force of law, that have more information on more citizens than could have been dreamed of even 20 years ago. And the centralization of power seems to be happening all the time without really any major break in that momentum. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of reasons to look at any ideological system that seeks to impose its will upon all people and control them. There are going to be similarities, whether they're religious or political. And by the way, Islamism, which is a term that is used to sort of separate out people who just show up at a mosque once in a while, or not once in a while, people show up at a mosque versus those who believe that, you know, the Sharia and Islam should be the deciding political factors in day-to-day, or deciding legal factors, I should say, in day-to-day life. Islamism is a very real thing. People who believe that Islam should be the state. This is the distinction, right? This is what Islamism really is. And so that's already a prevalent ideology in many parts of the world. I mean, you look at the Muslim world, and there are a number of countries for which Islam is considered the single guiding authority for state activity. And there are many, many tens, really hundreds of millions of people who believe that even if that's not the case yet where they live, that should be the case. That is the aspiration.
Yeah. And the confusion, I think, for the American public comes in the crossover of worldviews where, like, so you say that absolutism of authority with socialism and Islam. And what makes it confusing for Americans is that constitutionally, our worldview is all men were created equal and free. And so you have people looking at the Syrian refugees and saying, well, they should be free. I mean, they're just like you and me, and we're all, you know, seeing the possibilities of how great our world can be together, and they've got aspirations for world peace and wonderful things, and not really realizing that this is apples and oranges here. The aspirations of submission and control are not freedom and not equality. It's all about establishing, you know, more directive, not interactive, but dictatorial leadership. And so, you know, here we are, we're arguing with each other. I mean, I've got people telling me that, you know, I'm bigoted and I'm you know, racist and all that kind of stuff. And they're like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, first of all, Islam isn't a race. Okay. And second of all, if you include that entire group of people in your universal worldview, then you're saying that their freedom is the same as your freedom. And it's
right. Well,
there's
a big David. Thank you for calling in. There's a big disconnect here. This idea that everybody wants the same freedoms and beliefs and the same things is obviously not true. The Islamists know that that's not true, but we are fed this by our government. It is a lie, and it is one that we need to stand up against. This is kind of going down a fascinating path here. We'll have to do more of this, in a minute, but also next week. I'll be right back.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton.
Team, we know President Obama has told us that we shouldn't worry, that they're on this, they've got this, everything is going to be fine. Well, my next guest, who's a first-timer here on the Buck Sexton Show, says that President Obama needs to come clean on ISIS before it's too late. I want to ask her what she means and what we can do about all this. We have Adriana Cohen, who joins us from the Boston Herald now. She's also a radio host. Adriana, thank you for calling in.
Oh, thank you so much. Good to be with you, Buck.
So please tell me about this column. You're saying President Obama is essentially on the clock here, and he's running out of time to tell the truth about ISIS or to take ISIS seriously. What are your criticisms here of the approach? I know we don't have all day, but what are your criticisms of the president's policies?
Exactly. I mean, where do we begin? I mean, he said back in 2012 that al-Qaeda was on the run. Then our diplomatic outpost in Benghazi got hit. Four Americans were killed. So he was wrong there. Then flash forward to this year, he called ISIS a JV team. We know that certainly isn't true. ISIS is certainly on the march. They've established a caliphate, and now their tentacles are reaching all over the world. And then he recently said, you know, the day of the Paris attacks last Friday, he said ISIS was contained to Iraq and Syria, and clearly that isn't true. And so who could believe anything he says at this point? He's just been wrong so many times. And let's not forget that this is the same president who promised the American people over 37 times in different speeches, if you like your health care plan and your doctor, you can keep it.
I know you point out here in your piece for the Boston Herald that you've got, what, Susan Rice, Valerie Jarrett, Secretary of State John Kerry, and National Security right. Advisor Ben Rhodes as the incompetence on his national security team. This is quoting Lindsey Graham. But do you think that at this point, still President Obama's senior national security advisors, that those who are around him who can advise him on these issues, do you think even they're telling him it's a good job, or is it starting to get a little, there's a little heat in that White House now? What do you think?
I definitely think there's heat in the White House right now, because basically the public has caught on to the truth. I mean, President Obama's rhetoric and his political narrative that, you know, Islam is the religion of peace and that, yeah, we don't have to worry about ISIS, don't worry about that, it's just not true. I mean, right now you have Brussels that's in a state of emergency. They're in lockdown. Paris is in a state of emergency. And now Tunisia, just today, ISIS claimed responsibility for blowing up a bus. And now Tunisia's in a state of emergency. And so his rhetoric and his promises just don't add up to reality. And I'm sure that his inner security advisors are very frustrated, because I'm sure there are some good people in his administration who have been warning President Obama and his inner circle for years now, hey, the ISIS threat is really escalating. We need to pay attention to it. We need to pay attention to Boko Haram, who alone has displaced over 2 million Nigerians and committed, you know, horrendous atrocities similar to ISIS. And so President Obama has been warned, but as you know, Buck, there's been a report out now that says that it's possible that the intelligence reports could have been scrubbed to downplay the threat, which is very troubling.
Oh, I'm almost certain that they were. There's evidence mm-hmm. From within the intel community, which I used to be a part of, and so I know how right. these processes work, that there were reports that should have been read and that that the president should have paid attention to. And I think that very quickly there was what we would call pushback against those in the community.
Right.
People say, look, you don't want to be bringing this down to the White House. Let's take a different tone, a different analytic tone on all this. But the question I'd pose to you is, what do you think the president does now? Let's go with what should he do now instead of what he will do, because I think what he will do is nothing. But what
right.
should he do now, given the realities of ISIS staring the entire world in the face?
I think what he needs to do first and foremost is, I think, you know, if I were president advising him, I would say, you know, you need to increase surveillance of ISIS, especially on social media. You know, I think it's pretty pathetic that we need this hack of a site, Anonymous, to be shutting down thousands of ISIS propaganda sites on these social media networks like Twitter and Facebook. I mean, this really should be the job of our people, but they're overwhelmed. And so, you know, our intelligence officials, whether it's FBI, CIA, et cetera, they're overwhelmed with the vast number of these sites on social media that making matters worse, they were saying now they can't even keep up with the non-encrypted communications of ISIS and related terror groups. So now, making matters even more troubling is that a lot of their communication is now going dark, you know, encrypted or in the dark web. So they're having trouble keeping up with the amazing amounts of activity that's going on with ISIS. And so they need more support. So I think the president should, first and foremost, he should give the FBI and all our intelligence agencies whatever tools they need to fight this on the internet, number one, whether it's hiring more people or doing whatever is needed there. And then, of course, he needs to, bump up his game in terms of the fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. I mean, I thought it was pretty embarrassing, Buck, when you need France to come in and strike Raqqa, ISIS's headquarters, when the United States has been doing airstrikes for over a year and a half now. Why didn't the United States take out their headquarters? Why haven't we taken out their oil transportation? Why haven't we crippled their financial pipeline? I mean, it's been reported that ISIS has over, $2 billion. Well, that can't be stuffed in a mattress. That's going to be in banks somewhere around the world. Why isn't our intelligence agencies, seizing that money and crippling it? So there's so much more that can be done. And unfortunately, I don't think we have a commander-in-chief who's actually going to execute it, because, as you know, Buck, he's more interested in fighting climate change.
Oh, yes. And we'll see all of that on full display at the Paris talks coming up. Adriana Cohen, she is a radio host and also a columnist at the Boston Herald. Thank you for joining us for the first time here on the Buck Sexton Show. We really appreciate it.
Great to be with you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Thank you.
All right, team, if you have any nice Thanksgiving stories you would like to share or Thanksgiving thoughts for the rest of Team Buck, please do call in, because otherwise I'm talking about radical Islam and Islamism to close this thing out, and I don't know if that's going to give you indigestion with your turkey tomorrow or not. But that's probably where we're heading. So I leave it in your hands, my friends of Team Buck. 888-900-3393. We can talk turkey. Or I was going to make a really bad pun about turkey, but I'm going to bail on that. Or we can talk about Islamism. I'll be back in a minute.
Buck Sexton. The Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
So I wanted to finish my, I guess we could call it a rant, I don't know, my discussion with you on Hamtramck and juxtapose it actually with a story from Sweden right now. So here's the deal. People are talking about Hamtramck, and it's getting a lot of attention because it is a Muslim-majority city council. It's 40% Muslim, a lot of Muslim immigrants. And that has real consequences for the town, by the way. Sort of quality of life consequences. And this is not I know that people say it's Islamophobia, but it's not. The call to prayer is five times a day. It is early in the morning, and it can be very loud. And now you hear, Allahu Akbar very early in the morning, and you hear it five times throughout the course of the day. In a small town, if there are numerous mosques, this may be something that is irritating to you. You may not want to wake up in the morning with, look, I don't want to wake up because of garbage trucks in the morning, right? Like, there's a lot of things that can annoy you. And people have complained about this. They've complained about this, and they've tried to raise issues. And, of course, immediately they're told, oh, well, that's bigoted. What do you mean? Don't you want to hear, don't you want to hear the call to prayer in the morning first thing? Don't you want to hear the Maghreb prayer in the evening? And don't you want to hear? And it's, no, actually, I don't really want to hear that. I don't want to be subjected to that necessarily. And so you're starting to see some of this stuff come up. You also have women who are walking around the streets of a town in Michigan who are covered is the sort of the polite term, I guess, or maybe the euphemistic term. But we're talking about some head to toe hijab, which can be an abaya, which is the sort of full body, usually black full body covering, and the niqab, which is the face veil, which goes over that. And by the way, I've seen that I saw that there was a girls' school that I drove past once when I was in New Jersey. I'll never forget it. And I know bringing up New Jersey in this context, people are all freaked out. But there was a girls' school, and there were young girls, and they were wearing long, they were wearing abayas, essentially, at a girls' Muslim school, and they're 12 years old. And you could say that's fine, and that's, you know, religious freedom and everything else, but okay. But just so we're all clear, the decision to cover is for women within the Islamic world. They consider it a moral decision. So there are a whole bunch of dynamics here, meaning to not do it is immoral. And there are a whole bunch of dynamics here that come into play. So what does that mean for all the rest of us walking around? What does that mean for Western women walking around? Westernized, I should say, women walking around. Is that so they are a bunch of what's? There's a lot of places where these discussions should go if honesty and truthfulness is what matters, and they don't go there because of sensitivities, because of political correctness. But okay, so Hamtramck was a discussion this week, and the mayor was on CNN. I was actually in that segment, but didn't. I was just talking about mosque surveillance. And here, bottom line up front, some mosques need to be surveilled. Most of them don't. Okay, there you go. Pretty straightforward. You don't even have to watch the whole segment. There you go. Some really need it. Some don't. And in fact, most don't, and we should be fair about that. But I see this piece in the Daily Mail. We're told over here that we're so bigoted and anti-refugee and everything else. Meanwhile, in Sweden, which is, if you're thinking of a country that's supposed to be the most welcoming and loving and kind and shows the most largesse towards new immigrants, you would think Sweden. I mean, Sweden has really tried to be the global leader in, hey, just come here, even if your culture is really different and you don't give a what about how we do things and everything else, and we'll pay for your housing and we'll pay for your food and we'll let you go to our schools, but you won't want to. You want to set up your own schools. You know what? We'll pay for that too. And you don't even have to learn the language and anything you want because, hey, we're all just one big global family, man. Sweden's having some problems. I told you some weeks ago I was at a dinner party and I had the fortune for once in my life to actually be seated next to somebody randomly who was, about my age and female and rather attractive. And we were talking a bit about Sweden, and she was telling me about how, yeah, of course, she's open-minded and progressive and tolerant and basically a kind, cuddly socialist. But she's a little worried about this whole immigrant situation they've got going on over there. And people are complaining about it. Even sort of Swedes in good socialist standing are saying, they're not really, this isn't working out the way we thought it was going to work out. They're not all saying, yeah, you know, I speak Swedish and I feel like a part of Sweden and I'm, you know, we're all one family. Let's all sort of just dance in a circle together. Nope, that's not how it's playing out. In fact, while we're having this discussion in this country about whether we should bring in 10,000 immigrants, refugees, I should say, immigrants, we bring in a million a year, or we permanently take in some capacity a million non-U.S. citizens every year and make them permanent residents, right? Whether it's legal immigration, whether it's people getting green cards, everything put together, it's a million a year. It's a lot. So when people start throwing around terms like xenophobia, it's like, we're xenophobic? We're bringing in a large city's worth of new people every year and saying, you get to stay here forever. Now you're an American. I think it's kind of ridiculous to have a conversation about xenophobia in that context, especially when we're only talking about 10,000 people under very specific circumstances. But nonetheless, we're having that debate here, and there's been a lot of grandstanding and a lot of people pointing fingers about hating refugees and all the rest of it. And I've even in a few places pointed out, you know, yes, you know, some of us have been concerned about refugees in every context for their well-being and for our well-being and the security precautions and the humanitarian needs and everything else. For years, Obama administration all of a sudden is like, oh, we're all about these 10,000 refugees. And it was a distraction, by the way. It was brilliant on their part to get us talking about something, to allow the liberal left, instead of feeling like a bunch of naive clowns for thinking that Obama had ISIS contained, because he's been telling them that, it allowed the liberal left to do what they love to do, which is to feel like they're a bunch of heroes, tough guys, taking the, you know, taking the tough position in favor of humanity and, you know, everything else, right? It was just grandstanding, moral grandstanding, preening. And that was great because it got the discussion totally shifted from the failure of Obama to actually contain ISIS on the day of the Paris attacks when he said that he contained ISIS. Okay, while we're having that debate, here's what's going on over in Sweden. Here's how I'm tying this all together. This is from the Daily Mail. Thugs hurling stones, cars set on fire, and refugee children aged 5 escorted to school by police inside the once tranquil Swedish village at war with migrants housed in an emergency center. And it goes into some detail here and talks about what it's like in this Swedish town where they've brought in, yes, Muslim refugees. It's 150 kilometers from Stockholm, and people in this town are not happy. But you know what started this all? According to this report, according to this, at least this telling of it, you know, the refugees show up and they're angry and they're bored. There's not enough for them to do. They complain about their housing. They complain about the food. They say that they're not being taken care of well enough. Remember, you're assuming these are refugees who their choice, if you really believe that, you know, refugee policy is supposed to be instituted the way we do, at least in this country, their choice was basically come be in this other place or stay behind and probably die. And yet they're in Sweden and they're complaining about the food and the housing. And some of them started throwing rocks at motorists as they would drive by. So Swedes who are paying exorbitant taxes so that the state can redistribute wealth, including to the newly arrived immigrants. And this, remember, my very lovely Swedish dinner companion was telling me about this, that people are sick of this. They feel like they're paying really high taxes. And the migrants start throwing rocks. And now there are a series of burglaries. And then there are a series of assaults. And all of a sudden, crime is going up a little bit. And the Swedes are looking around like, what do we get out of this exactly? And now you've got full-fledged tensions. Now you've got migrant kids who haven't done anything, afraid of going to school. And you've got, this is just one little microcosm, my friends. This is just one little town in Sweden. So this idea that it all just works out perfectly, well, anyway, we'll tackle this more soon. Look, have a fantastic Thanksgiving with friends and family. Have a restful weekend and holiday. Enjoy lots of turkey and all kinds of yummy food. Excited to join you again on Monday. Shields high.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.